is 03-0417 Sierra State versus Glenn Hale. Arguing for the defendant of Glenn Hale is Stephen D. Phillips, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning. Steve Phillips for the petitioner, Glenn Hale. This case involves an armed robbery committed by two individuals, in which one of the two robbers shot and killed two of the three robbery victims. Robert Jones and Glenn Hale, my client, were separately tried and convicted for these offenses. At Mr. Jones's trial, David Sullivan testified that he had given the murder weapon used in these crimes to Mr. Hale sometime before the murders were committed. 2 months later, at Hale's trial, the state couldn't find Mr. Sullivan, and with the trial court's blessing, introduced against Hale Sullivan's prior testimony from Jones's trial. And the issues in this case are whether that testimony is inadmissible hearsay, whether its admission violated the Confrontation Clause, and if there was error, whether that error was harmless. What I intend to do is take these issues somewhat out of order. I recognize that the court normally does not address constitutional issues unless it has to, and that is why I started my brief with the hearsay issue. However, I think it's appropriate to focus the discussion on the Confrontation Clause, and I say that for several reasons. First of all, given the recent United States Supreme Court decision in Crawford versus Washington, I believe the confrontation issue is the easiest issue to resolve in this case. Second, I believe that Crawford largely renders academic the hearsay issue, because regardless of how similar the interests of co-defendants may be, it's my position that under the Confrontation Clause, the testimony introduced at one co-defendant's trial may never be used against the other co-defendant unless that co-defendant was present at the first trial. Third, I think it's appropriate to focus on the confrontation issue if for no other reason that this court is going to have to confront the issue of the meaning of the Confrontation Clause in this context sooner or later, and this is a good case for it to do so. So starting with the confrontation issue, the rule announced in the recent decision in Crawford is that, at least as far as testimonial hearsay is concerned, such evidence may be admitted against a criminal defendant if the declarant is unavailable and the defendant is afforded the opportunity for cross-examination. So first you have the requirement for Crawford to apply, that the evidence is testimonial, and I don't think there's any dispute that former testimony is testimonial. Second, that the declarant is unavailable, and we are not contending otherwise. So there's really no dispute on those two parts of the test. But the third prong of this rule, I believe, is contested, and that is whether there was an opportunity for cross-examination. The state's position appears to be that by affording Mr. Jones the opportunity for cross-examination of David Sullivan, that fulfilled Mr. Hale's confrontation right. I guess for lack of a better shorthand term, I would call this confrontation by proxy. And it's my position that is never satisfactory under the Confrontation Clause. And I say that for several reasons. First of all, one of the interests, one of the most important interests protected by the Confrontation Clause is not merely that there be cross-examination, but that there be a face-to-face meeting between the accuser and the accused. And that's made very clear in a case decided about a decade ago, Coy versus Iowa, in which there was a screen, I believe, placed between the witness and the defendant.
Counselor, was there a preliminary hearing in this matter?
There was a preliminary hearing, I believe, but Mr. Sullivan did not testify at the preliminary hearing.
Was there an attempt to get in there to testify?
I don't think the record answers that question.
All right. Thank you. communications counsel, does your argument, when you talk about screen and under Constitution face-to-face, what implications does your argument have for some of the mechanisms or devices used with regard to children of tender age in sexual assault cases?
Well, of course, the decision in Coy was not an absolute. It did not establish an absolute rule that in all cases there must be a face-to-face confrontation between the witness or a face-to-face meeting between the witness and the defendant. But it said, you know, that at least in that particular case, there were no particular reasons why that face-to-face meeting wasn't allowed to happen. So in individual cases, I think Coy leaves open the possibility for, some measures to be taken to both afford the defendant his right to confrontation and the witness some protection, if that protection is necessary. But the problem in Coy was that, you know, it was basically a blanket rule that the trial court had established in that case and without having made a record as to the need for that protection. But, of course, in this case, there was no face-to-face meeting between Sullivan and Hale at all.
I also note that since this Crawford case, so there's a heightened sensitivity on this issue, and that our state constitution, if I recall, differs from the federal constitution with regard to confrontation. And, in fact, I think our state constitution says specifically face-to-face.
Yes, it does. You know, I think that's another example of why confrontation involves more than simply cross-examination. It's always been felt to involve a face-to-face meeting between the accuser and the accused, not simply so that the accuser can be cross-examined, but so that you force the witness to, you know, say it to my face. That's the idea there. If you're going to accuse me of something, say it to my face. And that is recognized in Coy, that when a witness is forced to make an accusation face-to-face with a defendant, sometimes the witness breaks down for reasons that possibly have to do with the truth of the witness's story. So
also, witnesses break down. Other reasons too. They're afraid to testify because there may be some events that may occur, or they have received some, or they have received threats, or they have concerns about I testify and something bad may happen to me.
That's true.
And so they get on the stand. I mean, I'm just going back. I've been a trial judge for a number of years before I came here, reflecting where I can think of a couple instances where people were intimidated or terrified about their testimony. So, I mean, I'm just throwing that out. That is a consideration.
Right, and that's why Coy did not establish an absolute rule. But, you know, I don't think that those considerations apply to this case because, you know, there was no meeting at all between Sullivan and Hale.
But I ask that. It seems to me, as I was reading the Crawford case, Justice Scalia talked about the meaning of the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause pretty much being set in 1790-something. Was there anything about these children, victims of sexual assault and all that in 1790?
I would doubt it. I would doubt that there was much litigation like that in 1790, but, you know,
I've been either, it seems to me, you have to say, we are not bound by what existed in 1790, or there's no possibility of anything less than face-to-face confrontation.
Well, anytime you have hearsay admitted against a defendant, there will not be face-to-face confrontation, at least insofar as, you know, at the time that the hearsay statement was made. And I think that, you know, that's why traditionally the hearsay exceptions have come to be recognized, is that, you know, if you were to interpret that language literally and absolutely, it would mean that hearsay evidence would never come in, and that's not the position of the courts. I was finished.
Crawford referred to Coy. I just don't remember that. Because in Coy, well, in the children's testimony case, there is cross-examination. There is an ability to talk to the child. Here it is a question of eyeball to eyeball.
Right.
This case, your argument is your defendant has not had the opportunity to cross-examine the unavailable witness. And you are unwilling to say that the cross-examination of by Jones's, is it Jones? Jones's lawyers is good enough for you and has no substitute. So it's not like he's behind the curtain. He's not there. You haven't questioned him. And you think Crawford covers that?
Yes. Yes, I think it does. There's nothing in Crawford. I guess getting back to the beginning of your question, yes, I don't think Crawford really discusses Coy.
And if I remember some of the children's cases, Scalia was a dissenter. He thought it had to be face-to-face.
Right.
Because that was his literal interpretation of the passage.
Right. He has always been the advocate of going back to what framers meant in 1790. That has always been his position, that we shouldn't depart from that.
Except that he'd cover military, including Air Force, even though the Constitution framers had no idea about planes.
Right.
Sometimes, that question. So sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Well, yeah, we could get into a discussion about
and this is a no.
Prudential philosophy.
And this is a no, at least here, where we have an unavailable witness and we're not dealing with technology.
Right, and the latter part of your question was, you know, exactly my position, that it's unfair to bind Mr. Hale to the cross-examination that was conducted by somebody else. And that's exactly why when Congress was considering adopting a hearsay exception like the one that we have, they rejected it in criminal cases with a specific note by the House Advisory Committee that it's unfair to make one party be bound by someone else's cross-examination.
Are you equating unfair to unconstitutional?
Well, I believe I am.
They don't always equate.
No, they don't. But you know, you have to interpret the Constitution in light of what the framers were trying to protect. And they were trying to protect the right of the accused to confront the witness, not the accused or somebody like him.
And that is your position hold, even if the two defendants' interests were precisely the same, the issue was precisely the same, the two lawyers were talking to each other, dealing with each other, advising each other, recognizing that their interests are the same and they're out after the same objective and means of getting there.
Yes, my position is that absolute, I guess you could say.
Counselor, I'd like you to look at the harmless error argument. I'd like you to tell me why we should not apply, why we shouldn't conclude that harmless error applies here.
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, I guess the state's position is that this evidence was unimportant, it was cumulative, it was collateral, it was vague, and I guess my perspective from reading a cold record of a trial that I wasn't at, it's very easy in retrospect to make all of those characterizations. But perhaps the best evidence of how the parties themselves who were actually at the trial and conducting the trial, how they viewed this evidence is what this court ought to look at. And if you look at it, what the prosecutor did in this case, I think the prosecutor would have a very difficult time with the state's characterizations of the importance of David Sullivan's testimony. Because, not only, even after the prosecutor saw Sullivan testify at Jones's trial, he still wanted him to testify at Hale's trial. So the idea that Sullivan's testimony wasn't very helpful to the state is of dubious validity.
Well, I'm just thinking here, the parties stipulated that this was a .44 revolver, .44 caliber gun. They stipulated that the gun that was in evidence was a gun used. And I'm just thinking you say the state said it's cumulative. Well, we had six witnesses and they all testified that this was a gun. And you're saying ultimately what you want, this was not a fair trial, therefore you want a retrial. At what point here the girlfriend testified she was riding with the defendant at a high rate of speed, and I believe that he urged her to throw the gun out of the vehicle because these are all things that happened.
Yes, it was the murder weapon. There's no question about that.
He had the murder weapon
six days after the murders were committed. And the critical factor here is that when he was arrested and interviewed by the police, he told the police that he got the gun 2 days after the murders were committed, and it wasn't really his. That, he put the gun in the car that night. What Sullivan's testimony does is establish that the gun was given to Hale before the murders were committed. And that's why Sullivan's testimony was so critical to the state. That's why they went to the trouble of trying to find Sullivan. When they couldn't find him, they searched residences. They basically turned Kenosha upside down trying to find Sullivan to bring him to the trial. That doesn't suggest to me that this was unimportant testimony. Then, once they couldn't find him, they had him declared unavailable, and they fought Hale's effort to preclude Sullivan's testimony from being introduced. They specifically told the trial judge that this evidence was important to their case, which again contradicts the state's present counsel and his characterization of this evidence. Then, in arguing to the jury, the prosecutor mentioned Sullivan's testimony in opening statements repeatedly during closing argument and again during the rebuttal. All of this would suggest to me that at least the prosecutor viewed this as important evidence, and it was. This was a circumstantial case against Mr. Hale, and the gun was the one thing that implicated him the most. There were other witnesses, certainly, who testified, and you mentioned the fleeing, for example, but there were...
And the fact that the girlfriend testified that she cut up and burned the black ski mask shortly after the night of the murders. But this is all... I guess that's what I'm referring to. At what point do we say, well, because I'm thinking there's no question about what Crawford does. The question about, for me, is, well, you look at this case, and wasn't there a lot of other evidence that came in disregarding whose gun it was and how he gave the gun to the, supposedly gave the gun to the defendant?
Well, there wasn't a lot of other evidence about whose gun it was and how it ended up with Hale. The only other person to say that Hale had the gun was Joy Baker, and she was also the person that was in the car with him when he fled. But as I point out in my brief, Joy Baker was given immunity by the state in this case to testify against Mr. Hale. She had already testified at the preliminary hearing. She had testified in a completely contradictory fashion to the way that she testified at trial. It was at that point that they gave her immunity and promised her sentencing consideration for her testimony. She obviously had an interest in implicating Mr. Hale at that point. And that's not to say that, you know, that, well, no juror would believe her. But there was a basis for the jury to discredit Baker's testimony, while at the same time, we didn't hear, you know, this impeachment evidence against David Sullivan. The defense counsel had said in his opening statement that he was prepared to produce this evidence, that Sullivan, too, was given immunity, that Sullivan had given inconsistent statements, but of course, since Sullivan didn't testify, that opportunity was lost.
But could I ask, you said that Mr. Hale told the police that he got the gun after the...
Yes, he did.
Was that a defense that was presented at trial?
Well, Mr. Hale didn't testify at trial. That is evidence that was admitted as part of the prosecution's case. They introduced his statement to the police. And I don't recall whether it was brought out in the cross-examination or direct examination, but it is testimony in the record, and I believe I've got the record sites in my brief.
What's the test for harmless error?
Well, the test is easily stated, but I guess less easily applied. The test is whether it can be said beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the conviction. And in the most recent cases from both this court and the United States Supreme Court, an alternative way of stating that, although it's not substantively different, an alternative way of stating that is that whether it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have convicted the defendant absent the error. And it's our position that it is not clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have done that. Could it have done so? Certainly. The evidence was sufficient, in other words, to convict Mr. Hale. But that's not the harmless error test that this court applies or that the United States Supreme Court applies either. The question is whether Sullivan's testimony contributed to the conviction. And, you know, I think it's clear that it did. Each link in the state's circumstantial case against Mr. Hale had witnesses to it. Now, there were witnesses that were granted immunity. There were witnesses that were granted sentencing consideration. The surviving eyewitness couldn't identify Mr. Hale. He could identify Mr. Jones, which is what made their interests, I contend, dissimilar. When the survivor was initially speaking to the police and testifying at the preliminary hearing, he was unable to describe the gunman, who he later said at trial must have been Mr. Hale. These are all weaknesses that once again, they don't mean that the evidence wasn't sufficient to convict him, but they do give the jury a basis for taking pause over Mr. Hale's guilt. And that is why something as dramatic as Mr. Sullivan's testimony, particularly since he was claiming to be a friend of Mr. Hale's, the jury would have to look at that testimony and say, why would a friend say that he gave the murder weapon before the murders were committed to Mr. Hale, unless it was true?
Is the police officer's statement that Hale told him he got the gun 2 days after the murder part of the record that the jury heard?
Yes.
Thank you. Agree that the confrontation clause was violated here. We then have to go and see whether this preliminary testimony fits the hearsay exception. We don't have to say whether it fits under 908.045.1, and we don't have to say whether it fits under 908.045.2.
5-6. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. That's why you start out with the confrontation. Now, if you should lose on the confrontation issue, then you have to get to, okay, we agree it's your testimony, hearsay, then we disagree, you and the state, as to whether or not it fits within the exceptions. Right? And what's your position on 908.045.1, which talks about similar interests? You hear it. Issue on that is dissimilar.
Right. My position is that the interests are dissimilar. One of the problems that we have in this case is that we don't really know what happened at Jones's trial. And it was the state's burden, you know, as a proponent of this evidence, to establish sufficient similarity to admit the testimony. And we don't know if Jones presented an alibi, if Jones was admitting he was there, or if Jones was saying Hale was there, but he wasn't there. We don't know what Jones's theory of defense was. And given that record, it's very difficult to say right off the bat that their interests were sufficiently similar. But, you know, aside from that, what you can tell just from Mr. Hale's trial is that Jones and Hale had very different problems because the survivor in this case had identified Jones, but not Hale. And the gun could be connected to Hale, but not Jones. Jones was the person that supposedly through a drug deal that had occurred several days before the murders had some connection to the victim's apartment, but that had nothing to do with Hale. And, you know, the state's theory seems to be that, well, Jones and Hale lived together, so if you implicate one of them, then you've implicated both of them. But, you know, even recognizing the fact that Jones and Hale left their apartment contemporaneously, shortly before the murder, the critical fact here is that nobody places them together after the murders. In fact, after the murders, and depending on how you view one of the witnesses' testimony, possibly even before the murders were committed, Hale goes back by himself to the residence of his grandfather and the grandfather's girlfriend. Jones goes back to their residence. So we don't know at what point Jones and Hale parted company. So to say that, you know, that both of them did this together and that, you know, implicating one implicates the other doesn't exactly fit the facts of this case.
What about the other one, residual exception?
Well, I guess my position on the residual exception is that, you know, we have, what is it, 28, 29 hearsay exceptions. And, you know, the language of the residual exception itself says that a statement not specifically covered by any of the foregoing exceptions but having comparable circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness is admissible. Well, this is specifically covered by one of the foregoing exceptions, the former testimony exception, and it simply doesn't fit that exception. That's the problem. And if you're going to circumvent one of the specific exceptions to admit this under a catch-all exception, there's no point in having those 28 or 29 hearsay exceptions. You can simply just have one exception that says, well, if we think it's reliable, it comes in. And that's not a very good rule for trial courts to apply. It certainly lends to confusion and unpredictable results. And that's exactly what, you know, the court is trying to prevent when it interprets these hearsay exceptions. So, you know, aside from the fact that there are certainly problems with Sullivan's testimony, which I think it detracts from how reliable that testimony would be. I don't think the court ought to use the residual exception for anything other than the unintended or unanticipated, I should say, situations that it was originally drafted to cover. This situation was anticipated by the former testimony exception. It simply doesn't meet the exception's requirements.
Thank you. your 5 minutes and rebuttal. Representing the state of Wisconsin as Assistant Attorney General, James M. Bryson.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing Respondent State of Wisconsin. This case presents a single evidentiary question. Is Defendant Hale entitled to a new trial on the ground that the trial court wrongly allowed into evidence former testimony that unavailable witness David Sullivan had given at the separate trial of Hale's co-defendant Robert Jones? The state asks this court to answer this question no. A new trial is not warranted for either of two reasons. Either the evidence was properly admitted, or if it was wrongly admitted, its admission was harmless error. This court accepted the petition for review from Defendant Hale in this case prior to Crawford v. Washington being issued by the United States Supreme Court. In the wake of Crawford, I believe the state's best argument ultimately here is going to be the harmless error argument. However, before discussing the supporting facts for harmless error, which is a very fact-intensive argument, in fact, I have 18 points on harmless error that I would hope to get to, I will very quickly, or I'd like very quickly to outline the state's argument on the admissibility question, admissibility of evidence, the confrontation clause, and hearsay. I also would suggest that although this court could jump past that in this case, if it felt that harmless error was dispositive, that this, regardless of whether it was admissible or not, it was harmless error, I do agree with the defense that I think it's worthwhile in this case to address the admissibility question as guidance to the courts and to criminal law practitioners down the road, because it is probably going to occur again. And it is in part because Wisconsin is rather unique in its former testimony hearsay exception, in that it allows in criminal cases as the defense called it, proxy, similar motive and interest, a party, if the defendant is not a party to that prior proceeding under Wisconsin's former testimony hearsay exception, unlike every other state except two, the testimony still can come in if the party that at that other proceeding had a similar motive and interest to the defendant in cross-examining that witness.
Let me clarify that, counsel. Do you think that this court has to, or should, in its written opinion, engage in the threshold analysis as to whether or not this is admissible under the statutory exceptions?
If this court were to conclude that Crawford means that there has to be face-to-face confrontation by the defendant or the defendant's counsel to satisfy confrontation. In other words, that, like in this case, Robert Jones and his counsel cross-examining David Sullivan isn't good enough, then it's confrontation clause error. This court wouldn't have to worry about hearsay. Hearsay was only going to be important. Hearsay exceptions here are only important if, in order to get this admitted, it has to meet both hearsay and confrontation.
Normally, we follow the maxim that if you can dispose of a case, or you first look at the statutory basis, if you don't have to get to the constitutional basis. And, of course, in this case, you don't really know. I mean, there's an argument that you could just resolve it on the statutory basis. You don't know that until you go through it, you know, whether it can be resolved. But are you suggesting that we should then not address admissibility on the statutory basis and say, assuming or without addressing that it may be admissible, then just get to the Crawford issue? Is that what you're suggesting? And then harmless error?
Not entirely. I'm just saying that if this court were convinced that there was confrontation clause error in this case, it would moot out the former testimony hearsay exception. It would leave, I mean, the residual hearsay exception would still be available as a basis to satisfy the rules of evidence, but if there's a confrontation clause violation that's been preserved, and that I should make a point here, that in my brief, I did suggest that in the trial court, the defense had arguably had waived a federal confrontation clause objection by limited reference to the the federal constitution and one mention of Ohio Roberts. In other words, the focus in the trial court was on unusual circumstances. I suggested in my brief that that was peculiar to the state constitution of the House of Confrontation Clause. I'm no longer of that mind, and I'm not suggesting that waiver is appropriate in this case. I did, with respect to the analysis of the evidentiary question, again, if, only if, and there's probably language in Crawford, I have to admit, that suggests that there may very well be a confrontation clause error here.
We're artful in your brief, and you said that one, that Crawford could be read. I think that's the way you said.
Well, there are two problems that I see with the state's position on confrontation clause, and I'll be upfront and articulate them. One is in Crawford, the United States Supreme Court specifically picks out State versus Betts as a problematic case. This case, as far as I can tell, even under the state's co-defendant A, co-defendant B analysis in the brief, where they have either equally culpable, they're charged with the same crimes that both parties are charged as parties. Their defense is, as far as I can tell, based on what the trial court said about this issue, is that they both were seeking acquittal. And the evidence in question, the Sullivan testimony about the gun, was inculpatory of both. I was suggesting that under that scenario, where those factors are present, arguably at least, the argument could be made that Jones's cross-examination, albeit not face-to-face, although Hill doesn't do it face-to-face with Sullivan, Jones's cross-examination is almost as good as Sullivan's. And
if I can stop you, because both of you have talked about face-to-face confrontation. Crawford doesn't require face-to-face confrontation, does it? It doesn't require that the defendant had a prior opportunity for cross-examination. It doesn't link it to face-to-face, does it?
They don't talk about it. The focus in Crawford is on the opportunity, adequate opportunity for cross-exam.
And did the defendant have an adequate opportunity in this case?
The state's suggesting through co-defendant Jones's cross-examination.
That was Jones's cross-examination. Right. Did the defendant Hale have an opportunity to cross-examine?
He did not cross-examine Sullivan at any point, face-to-face at any point. And the only way the state can defeat the Crawford suggestion of adequate opportunity is through this proxy, through Jones. And the only reason this is even available as an argument to the state is because of the fact that the state has this former testimony exception that gets you past the
argument that's sort of agency theory.
Exactly. Well, not in the true sense, I guess. I mean, just that it's the three points that I was articulating earlier. If those are all present, they have the same interest in attacking Sullivan's testimony. Let me throw a caveat to that, though, because this is the other problem that I see with the state's position here. And I want to quickly get to harmless error because I don't want to keep knocking the state down here. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought now, too.
The real trouble is Vince.
Vince is a problem. Well, I know what I was going to say. With respect to the state's argument that you could somehow interchange Hale for Jones, the one problem with that is that Hale does not have the opportunity, for example, to present evidence of possible bias against Hale personally. So if you were going to find that you could have confrontation clause satisfied by proxy by the co-defendant with these three factors being met, you probably also would have to, the state would also have to agree somehow to stipulate that evidence of bias or other information that the defendant Hale, by virtue of not being able to cross-examine Sullivan, should be allowed to get in. It becomes cumbersome, and it's an argument that's available, and I've made the argument, but I think ultimately here the state's best argument is harmless error, and unless there are further questions.
Or just one simple one. No matter how the court ruled, testimonials, there are several questions still open under Crawford. One, what is testimonial? That's not here, but that's open. Two, you have a right to cross-examine at the preliminary, but it's a restricted right. And Crawford leaves open whether that's good enough, too.
Yeah, there are two cases coming before the court this term that deal with both of those questions. The first one is Manuel with
That's testimonial, I think.
That's testimonial versus non-testimonial. And that raises the issue, and I'll just give you a quick forecast of where I think the state's going to come down on that, is that you first look at whether it's testimonial or non-testimonial. If it's non-testimonial, you don't need to go into the confrontation clause analysis any further. That is purely decided under rules of evidence. That's where the state's going to come down. Now, that's going to be opposite to the defense. That's the Manuel case.
And what's the other one?
The other case is Stewart. That was before the court before earlier, and that is whether the preliminary examination, cross-examination of the witness was adequate
to
protect confrontation clause.
All right. Let's get to
harmless error. All right. I think, first of all, the standard. Chapman versus California is the standard for harmless federal constitutional error. In Wisconsin, Harvey, I think, is also the articulation of that standard. There's two formulations, and I'll articulate them both, and I'm going to suggest that it meets both of these. One standard, and this comes from Harvey, I believe, is it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found Hale guilty absent the evidentiary or confrontation clause error. The second one.
Harvey based on Nader?
Harvey is, I believe, based on
Chapman.
Nader, but from our perspective, Nader and Chapman are not different.
Okay. The
articulation.
Is it okay with the state then if we use Chapman?
I'm sorry?
Is it okay with the state if we use Chapman?
Yes.
Okay.
At least, well, I think in this case, whichever one you use, I don't want to.
I know.
In case we're having some, I don't know of any other case where this is directly at issue, but the other articulation is the one that's quoted from Chapman, and that is, it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict. Just to flesh out just real quickly on those tests, I'm not suggesting sufficiency of the evidence is the answer, and I'm not suggesting a mere weighing of state evidence and defense evidence is the answer. You look at the whole ball of wax, if you will, you look at the importance of the defense evidence and how that fits into the entire case and whether a jury would be so enamored with that particular evidence that but for its admission it would have made a difference. And that leads me into this, the specifics of this case. And I think all the possible considerations on that topic are present here. To begin with, Sullivan's testimony as to giving the gun to Hale was really collateral as to the fact that, as to when Hale got the gun. When Hale got the gun, Hale had the gun 6 days after the murder and has stipulated that that's the murder weapon. When he got the gun, Sullivan testified that he was guessing, he used the word, I guess I gave it to him 6 months before the double homicide, which would have been in November 2001, and the homicide was December 8th, 2001. So his testimony, even on that critical point, was speculative. On the other hand, the state had Joy Baker, who testified that Sullivan, she was present, Sullivan gave the gun to Hale a few days before the double homicide. About a week before, I guess, was her testimony. The evidence of the fact that Hale was the mass gunman is overwhelming. Mark Bernhardt, the surviving eyewitness, positively identified Robert Jones as one of the two intruders. Jones was married to Hale's sister, and Hale was living with Jones.
Could I ask you to comment, counsel, on the so-called defense that Mr. Hale didn't get the gun until 2 days after the homicides?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Mr. Phillips suggests that evidence came out at trial that Hale had a defense that he didn't get the gun until 2 days after the homicide. How important was that as part of the defense, and how important was Sullivan's testimony in rebuttal of that defense?
The testimony that you're talking about is a police officer testified on direct examination by the state During an interview with Hale after his arrest, Hale said he had gotten a gun from, and I can't think of the person's name now, a specific person on December 10th, which would have been 2 days afterward. That was the basis for the defense getting. That was the only evidence on that subject from the defense.
Someone other than Sullivan.
That was through Hale's statement to police, came in through the police officer. That was Hale saying that.
But was he saying that he got it from someone other than Sullivan?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, yes.
So Sullivan would be rebutting that part of it.
Yes, he would certainly rebut that, as would Joy Baker, of course.
And that would show that what statement that he was making was not true.
That Hale's statement was not true. Yes, Baker rebuts Hale's statement to the police that claiming that he got the gun afterward was rebutted both by the read-in testimony of Sullivan and by Joy Baker's testimony at trial, saying, "I was there. Sullivan gave the gun to Hale about a week before the double homicide." On the date of the double homicide, December 8th, Hale and Jones were together at home where they're living together a half hour before the double homicide. They then went to Hale's grandfather's house where they talked privately in the bathroom and then left together. Hale, short in stature, was wearing the black coat with a hood that police later found in the car in which Hale led police on a high-speed chase. Survivor Bernhardt at the crime scene. He said Jones's accomplice, the gunman, was short, black, wearing a black ski mask, black hooded sweater, and black gloves, wielding a worn-looking revolver. After the shooting, Bernhardt got to a bathroom window. He's a car buff. He saw the perpetrators leave in a car whose profile resembled an 89 Chevy Beretta, a black 89 Chevy Corsica, which looks like a Beretta in profile, was parked at Hale's mother's residence 2 days after the double homicide. The crime scene was close enough to Jones and Hale's residence and that of Hale's grandfather that Hale could have committed the crimes and returned to his grandfather's house as soon as 15 minutes afterward, so that even the testimony of Hale's grandfather's friend, Vera Blaylock, that Hale was gone and back within that period of time, still wouldn't have been an alibi for Hale. For six days after the double homicide, Hale and his girlfriend lived in a hotel and drove a rental car. Now, if Hale was concerned about being picked up for a problem in Tennessee, not until after the homicide did he bother to try to live at a location that he wouldn't be easily found. When Hale picked up Joy Baker, his girlfriend, after work on December 14th, 6 days after the homicide, police tried to stop him. Hale then drove away and led police on a high-speed chase on I-94 from Kenosha to Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, Hale jumped from the driver's seat of the moving car, and he took off running before police caught him. In the car, police found a fully loaded .44 Magnum revolver beneath the driver's seat. The party stipulated that this was the murder weapon in the double homicide. Also in the car were a shoulder holster for the gun, bullets, a black hooded jacket, as I mentioned, and a police scanner. Baker, who had been in the front passenger seat, said she helped Hale unstrap the shoulder holster, and that Hale had told her to toss the gun and bullets out the window, but she decided to put them under the seat instead. As noted, Baker said Hale got the gun from Sullivan a few days before the double homicide, and she said that Hale wore it a lot. Baker also said that during the chase, Hale told her it probably would be the last time she'd see him, and asked her to write him in jail. Excuse me, sir. Baker also said that shortly before the double homicide, Hale bought a black ski mask. She said that after Hale was arrested, Hale told her that he had hidden the ski mask beneath the cardboard of her duffel bag and that she should get rid of it, which she and another woman ultimately did. After Hale was taken to jail in the backseat of a squad car, police found black gloves stuffed behind the seat. At one point in jail, after his arrest, Hale, teary-eyed, told the detective, quote, "Man, if I did it, I just don't remember," unquote. Hale then repeated that statement for another detective. Finally, Hale confessed the double homicide to fellow inmate James Toy in details that mimicked survivor Bernhardt's account, including the information that the intruders had knocked on the apartment door using the name Vinny reason Bernhardt was not shot was because Jones happened to be in the line of fire. Hale told his fellow inmate Toy that his only regret was not killing Jones. In light of all these considerations, then, including this overwhelming evidence of Hale's guilt, if error occurred in the admission of Sullivan's prompt testimony at Hale's trial, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would ask the court to so conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Justice Price.
Help me once more. There is a mountain of evidence. What is the test that one important piece of evidence didn't contribute? I mean, how do I rule out that? I don't quite understand.
The meaning of what does contribute mean to the verdict? The best I can say about that is it's a contextual kind of thing. And the best way you can look at it, I mean, every piece of evidence that the state's going to present, and defense counsel pointed out, for example, that the prosecutor made an effort to point out Sullivan's testimony. On that point, I just would note that he actually did Baker and Sullivan together on that point. It wasn't just Sullivan. But from that standpoint, every evidence that the prosecutor wants to put in, especially in a circumstantial type case, is going to be important, important to the case. But where that evidence is in this case, the disputed evidence, is equivocal, like on the key point, when the gun was given to Hale, to rebut Hale's statement to the police. And where you've got another witness who says that it was before the homicide, the importance of that disputed evidence is minimized. And then, that's one aspect you've got over here. And then when you look at the entire case, the rest of the state's evidence, you can say, if I'm a juror and I'm looking at the disputed evidence and its problems, and I'm looking at all the other evidence of the state's case, that disputed evidence could not reasonably have contributed, or cannot reasonably contribute to my decision, or if I'm the court, could not reasonably have contributed to the jury's decision. I don't have a better answer for that other than a dictionary definition, I guess. I have not shepherdized Chapman to see how they have defined contributed to.
Well, our court has set forth various things you might look at. I've forgotten the name of the case. Is it Bailey? I've forgotten the name of the case in which it started to do that. It's an older case, but we've cited it since. So you might look at the opening argument. So that, see how the state put it in context. Right?
Sure.
Might look at the nature of examination and cross-examination. You might look at closing argument, for example, for context.
Sure.
And I have forgotten the other, if there were any, that we set forth. But
well, the entire evidence of the trial and the value of this particular
evidence,
whether it's cumulative or not.
Yeah, we have to redundant.
Sure.
17 witnesses testified to the same thing, and the 18th witness should have been struck, but it wasn't. Then you might say it's not contributory.
Joy Baker testified at Hale's trial, but she also testified at some preliminary examinations, I believe, that there were some inconsistencies in that testimony.
That's correct.
Wasn't there some explanation that she was urged to lie in that prelim testimony?